comparison with what they were used to at home, that the Soviet regime had to put up placards all over the place telling and warning the Russian people, don't listen to what these soldiers tell you. They're just talking through their hats, don't believe them. There was a real fear that these returned soldiers would give the Russian people the idea that this whole Soviet paradise was a hoax, and that even the Eastern European countries were far better off than Russia itself. Now, suppose those Russian troops were to march on into Western Europe. Suppose they were to see not the ruined cities of Eastern Germany, but suppose they were to see Paris and Brussels and Rome and Copenhagen and some of these other cities of Western Europe after what they have been used to at home. And then they have the problem of holding all this area, of all this land. Aren't they going to run into difficulty there? And then, too, if a war does come, if the Russians do march across Western Europe against a united Western Europe with no split in it, with no divisions, how are their own satellite peoples going to feel? How are the 15 million political prisoners now working at slave labor going to feel? There isn't going to be any revolution in Russia, any uprising, without war. The Russians can hold these satellite countries in line. They can hold through their police system their 15 million slave laborers in line. But let a war come, and then a very different situation develops. And I think that is one of the reasons why the Russians are holding back so on this matter of marching across Europe. Now look at it again. Now take a look at it from our point of view. The Russians, when they hold their people back, when they don't march across Western Europe, they're figuring this. We are now talking about rearming Western Germany. There's discussion along those lines. We say that we may have some West German units, combat teams, they call them, to be included in the West European army. Immediately, the Russians ask for a conference on that. Immediately, they make a great uproar. Now, the Russians aren't scared of a rearmed Western Germany. It would take a couple of years for it to get anywhere. It wouldn't amount to much if Western Germany were rearmed. The number of divisions would be of no great consequence in any near future. But in saying that we are going to rearm Western Germany, we give the Russians a magnificent propaganda argument, a magnificent propaganda weapon. They can turn to the people in the satellite countries and say, see, to the Czechs and the Poles, who aren't a bit happy under Russian rule. They can turn to the Czechs and the Poles and say, see what these warmongering Americans are doing. They're getting ready to rearm those Germans, the same Germans who invaded and took over your country and killed so many of your people only a few years ago. You better stay along with us. And in like manner, they can say to the French, on our side of the Iron Curtain, in the free world, they can say to many of the people of Western Europe, who are very much alarmed about the Germans, they can say, see, the Americans are building up the German menace, the German war machine again. Now, it's not what the German war machine looks like to you and me and to the people of the United States who've not had quite such direct experience with it. It's what the German war machine and the fear of that war machine looks like, for instance, to the people of France. Since 1870, the French have been three times attacked by the Germans. In both 1914 and in 1940, the Russians were fighting against the Germans on the same side with the French. Therefore, it is just natural, no matter what you or I or anyone else may say to the French, it is very natural for the French to have this feeling that the Russians are not so great a danger as the Germans and that the Germans are the number one enemy. The Poles are divided in their mind. They've had bad experience with the Russians, bad experience with the Germans. The Czechs have had considerably worse experience with the Germans than with the Russians, though they're having a kind of a bad experience with the Russians right now. But if we make some such move as this business of rearming Western Germany, then a possibility comes for the Russians to move across Western Europe. Then they might make an attack on the theory that under those conditions, the French would not support us. The Dutch, the Norwegians, the Danes would not support us or would be lukewarm. The British wouldn't be too enthusiastic. And their own satellites would not so easily break away if we are to rearm Western Germany. Now, this isn't a speech I'm making against the rearmament of Western Germany. I'm just taking one matter, one topic, one condition that is in the news right now. Another thing that could also lead to this kind of trouble that I speak of, this sort of a division in the United Nations or in the West European nations, the North Atlantic Pact countries, would be the possibility that we get bogged down in some long-range war in China and in Asia. There was a lot of fear about that. That doesn't look like such an immediate and urgent danger right now as it did in the early stages of the communist intrusion into the Korean War. But it is a possibility, and it is still there. If, again, we get ourselves all bogged down in a piece of fighting in Asia, whether in Korea or in China, a good many people in Europe may feel that we have no particular interest in the fate of Europe, which is, I think, much more important to us than the fate of Asia, and that would give the Russians, again, a green light, perhaps, to move ahead, feeling that we are too tied up in the Asiatic part of the world. That's one of the points that Stoneman makes in his dispatch today. And don't forget this danger of the this business in Eastern Europe, the question of these satellite countries. Lippmann had a very good column about the importance of the satellite countries and their government in the News Gazette just yesterday. He pointed out that it's maybe a good idea to build up these countries, to play with their governments as best we can, do what we can with them. Maybe at some future time they might be on our side. After all, you had it happen in Yugoslavia. There was a satellite that rebelled. There are reports in the press, you hear them, and you get them from time to time, that the Russians do not allow these satellite countries, satellite armies, to use, to carry and have any ammunition. The fear that the troops in those armies will turn that ammunition against their Russian masters. It is not a very encouraging sign from the Russian point of view, from the point of view of their strength, if at the head of the Polish army they have to have a Russian field marshal, Rokossovsky. That's not a sign of great loyalty and great strength and great devotion to the Soviet cause on the part of these of the Polish people. And as I said before, all the people in slave labor camps in Russia give us an idea that perhaps things aren't as good there as they might be. I think in all this talk we hear about the great strength of the Russian army, the great strength of Russia, the great skill of Russian diplomacy, there's a great deal in all that. I don't mean to minimize it at all. But I also want to sketch in this other side of the picture, these weaknesses and fears on the part of the Russians. I've mentioned the question of China and Asia. In the long run on this business of China, Chinese-Russian cooperation, in the long run, I don't think there's much doubt that China and Russia will eventually be at odds. There will eventually be a falling out. Chiang Kai-shek was in power, the one-party system, a one-party government in China, for about 20 years. It's quite possible that the Mao Zedong government, the Chinese Communist government, would last as long as that. It's not something that's going to be all cleared up tomorrow. Mao Zedong isn't going to come right on over to our side. From our point of view, look at the ties, the relationships, all the bonds between ourselves and the Europeans as compared with our bonds with the Asiatics. This country, almost everybody in America has some relative, some blood connection, some sort of relation in Europe. Almost everyone in Europe has some family contact with the United States. There's some sort of bonds, even back of the Iron Curtain and all over. There's always been this going back and forth between ourselves and the Europeans. Our language, our religion, and our customs, our traditions, and all that are all intermingled and tied together. And those factors, especially when you are confronted with the menace of a godless atheistic system such as the Russian system threatening Europe, what it means to the Roman Catholic Church, for example, and the Protestant churches which have such strength in Europe, when you consider all that, those ties between ourselves and Europe are just going to be too strong to be denied. I don't care what anybody may say about it, politically or any other way, or from the point of view of our interests or anything else. I think those ties of sentiment, which were pretty strong between ourselves and the British during the dark months of 1940, are going to be ever so much stronger. if there is a move of the Russians to take over the whole of the European continent, with all that that implies to the values of Europe and the traditions that we share with Europeans. I think that is a factor of very enormous weight, which it's very hard to overestimate, which you can't weigh exactly in the scales, but which is always there, and that is going to be strong. On the other hand, in China and in Asia, there is a tremendous revolution breaking out all through that part of the world. Half the human race is on the march. They want to have their own governments, their own national unities, their own national sovereignty. India and China in the lead, Indonesia, Burma, and all these others. We have become identified, and I don't suppose it could be helped, we have become identified with the old colonial system of the British, the French, the Dutch, the Germans, and the rest, even though our treatment of the Philippines was much better than that of the European nations, even though the Philippines was the one country that stood out against the Japanese in the war against Japan. In spite of all that, the color line and all our connections at the present time with Britain and France and the rest of it make it very difficult for us to appear in the eyes of these people of Asia as their emancipators and their liberators, as the people who will give them the freedom they want. The Russians, on the other hand, have successfully identified themselves with that cause. Eventually, as I say, I feel perfectly certain that if the Russians continue, as they have done so far, to play their own national imperial game, they are going to come to grief and fail and get into difficulties with the Chinese, with the Indians, with any other people on whom they try to encroach. But I submit that it is way beyond our power, way beyond our strength, and really outside our field of interest to take as strong a line in Asia as we will have to and as we should do in Europe. There are not the same ties, there are not the same interests. I'm by no means minimizing this revolution in Europe, in Asia, I should say. I think it's the big thing of our time, the greatest thing that's happening in the world today, the most important change that's happening anywhere. And it's going to mean a completely new life for more than half the human race. Europe, on the other hand, to which we happen to be tied, is in a period of decline. There's no doubt about that either. But we've got to face up to that and recognize that that is the kind of world in which we live. Now, I think there are, you might say, broadly speaking, then, there are four possibilities that I could see coming out of this general sort of analysis of the way the world today looks. One would be that the Russians, and I'm not being dogmatic, and I'm trying not to in any of these points, maybe Lloyd's will lose that bet. Maybe the Russians will attack, either through desperation, maybe much worse off than we have any knowledge of, and they would just shoot the works anytime, the only way out for them. That could happen. Or more likely, I think, they might make an attack through a misunderstanding, through misinformation, through a belief either that we wouldn't fight, that we couldn't fight, that they were going to get support that didn't exist, that there might be some split or other developed. They might, of course, at any time move in because they have got the strength to do so. As I say, I've given the reasons why I think they have not made that strike so far, reasons that go beyond the question of the atomic bomb. That's one possibility. There's another possibility, which is that the Russians may crack up, either with or without war. It could happen that the death of Stalin or some internal upheaval, some palace revolution, could lead to a very different type of regime in Russia. It could be that if the Russians were to make this this desperate lunge that I speak of, a sudden attack, just because there was no other way out for them, it could be that you would find that they were very much weaker than anyone thinks they are, that there would be these uprisings inside Russia, in the satellite countries and the rest of it. They might find that they were very ill-prepared and ill-equipped to make the kind of attack that the military men talk about. I can't help but remember, when you hear these military men tell you the Russians can be at the English Channel in 3 weeks, those are exactly the same military men, I remember them, in the summer of 1941 who told you that the Germans would be in Moscow in 6 weeks. So just don't be too sure that the military men are always right, because as a matter of fact, in most of the things to do with the war, military men have been almost always wrong. The point being that war is full of nothing but the unexpected. It's the only thing that happens in warfare, the unexpected things. So that, although it is only logical, reasonable, and proper to assume that the Russians could make this big lunge across Europe, it is always possible that the whole thing might crack up, fall down, blow up, and all sorts of unexpected things would happen. A third possibility is, of course, that the crack up might not be on the Russian side, but on our side. That there again, there might be unexpected weaknesses and difficulties developing, and all the Russian hopes for a division and a split, with or without war, would come to pass. Depression in this country, reversion to isolation, neutral governments coming up in Europe, and the Russians being able to get what they want without war. And then finally, there's the other, still another possibility, which is that when we get our strength up to a certain point, in the military way and in other ways, and the Russians see that we've got what it takes, that we have not had a depression here, that we have held the Western alliance together, that it's growing and getting stronger, and that there's no chance of their being able to neutralize Europe, why then they may decide, as they have repeatedly before in their history, that the thing to do is to strike a balance.